In 1975, an average-looking middle-aged mother of four named Sarah Jane Moore came within inches of killing President Gerald Ford. She pleaded guilty without ever fully explaining why she did this, and she was sentenced to life in prison. This morning, we'll be talking with investigative journalist Jerry Spieler about her book, Taking Aim at the President. The book tries to explore Sarah Jane, her life, talks about her lifelong tendency to obscure her identity and mislead people around her. It also tries to take a look at the ways that the political climate of the time influenced her actions. The book is recently published. Palgrave Macmillan is the publisher, if you'd like to take a look at the book. Our guest has written for the Los Angeles Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, and Forbes. She makes her home in San Francisco, and she's joining us this morning by telephone. And Ms. Spieler, hello.
Good morning.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I think it's a very interesting story, and it's one of those things that I think is kind of a forgotten story. People might just have a vague, if you mention the name Sarah Jane Moore, they might have a vague association with it, but probably not very much. And to be able to go into it in this kind of depth, I think, is really interesting.
Well, it's sort of like a footnote in history, and actually it's good news that people don't remember. Because fortunately, President Ford, was not hit,
yeah.
And that's a good part. The other thing people do is, confuse it with Squeaky Fromm, because she was a Manson woman, and so she had that notoriety. But Squeaky was really not there to assassinate President Ford. She just waved her gun around; it wasn't loaded. She wanted to get arrested. Sarah Jane Moore was a potential very serious assassin.
Yeah. Well, first, let me give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about how it was that you first came to meet and know Sarah Jane Moore.
That's it's sort of an interesting story. I was working in Los Angeles. I was a young mother of a little boy, and I had written a story about a class action suit against Sybil Brand Jail, which is the largest women's jail. And Sarah Jane, at the time, this was after she shot at Ford, was being evaluated by the psychiatrist in a facility in San Diego. And they received the newspaper. She read it, maybe thought I would be a sympathizer, I don't know, but sent me a handwritten note saying I'd like to meet you, and I know I'll be incarcerated in Southern California. And I was curious. I was a journalist. I was curious. I'd never met anyone who tried to kill a president. So I did go to meet her.
And then over a period of years, you corresponded, you met with her, you talked with her, and then things really changed. The nature of this relationship really changed at the point where she, Sarah Jane, suggested to you that you write a book about her.
Yeah, the relationship had no agenda. The reason I even started, visiting her after that was because of her son. I was the mother of a son, and her son was nine, and it broke my heart about him. And I agreed to send, Christmas presents and birthday presents on her behalf. So that kept the connection going. And also, coincidentally at the time, I was the president of a local chapter of the National Organization for Women, and Sarah Jane decided that she wanted to get a chapter chartered at the prison. So that connection kept going, and then it just went on its own energy. She had talked about writing a book. She'd had some publishers visit her. I never intended to write about her. I didn't write books. I was a journalist. But yes, when 27 years later, she said at one point, well, maybe it's time you got back to your writing, real writing, and why don't we write my book? And that changed everything.
Yeah. Well, and apparently what happened was that you took this suggestion seriously. You thought, well, maybe that would be interesting. And when she realized that what you would do was actually to do research into her life and it wouldn't simply be the story of her life as she would want it to be presented, then she broke off the relationship that you had. And since then, you haven't spoken.
That's exactly right. It was really shocking. It was a persona I had never seen, and the red flag. I think because the relationship was so casual,
mm-hmm.
and I don't go around researching every person I talk to. I accepted anything she told me because it didn't matter. She was at the corner of my life and pleasant, interesting visits, and I didn't have a Bible under my arm, and I wasn't a fan, and you know, I just visited her. And so I don't think she expected that I would take my journalistic skills and do my job. The first time I asked her what it was like to grow up in Charleston, West Virginia, her head snapped around. And she looked at me and she said, "I never told you that." And I said, "Well, no, but it's been all over the press. Everyone knows it's where you grew up. But I never told you that."
Mm-hmm. And so this is just, even though you had indeed met her a long time ago and had this kind of relationship over a long time, that people should understand that, the book is in no way an authorized biography.
No.
Yeah. You had an opportunity to meet her parents in there in West Virginia?
Her parents were dead. But I have met and spoken with her surviving brothers and her surviving children, who actually are brothers, brothers and sisters. Her parents adopted Sarah Jane's, three at the time, children that she abandoned. So there are surviving three brothers, and then there are her three children. So there's two boys and a girl. One girl that she gave birth to is, I don't know what happened to her. She was institutionalized right after birth. And then there was a sister who is also deceased, and there are three surviving brothers. And I have been able to talk with them and get tremendous amounts of detail and intimate background of her childhood, and also some of her schoolmates.
A couple of things that emerge if you look at her childhood and what she was doing when she was in school. It seemed that as a young girl, young woman, she was very bright, and she also had this talent for theater, which perhaps should maybe in retrospect it tells you something about her.
Yeah, all of the children in this family, and I think the press that went out at the time really painted an incorrect portrait of Sarah Jane and her family. Her father was a chemical engineer and an accomplished musician. Her mother was a violinist with the Charleston Symphony Orchestra. And Sarah Jane and her siblings were very bright and very talented. And the interesting thing is Sarah Jane wanted to be the center of attention, yet she was also a loner and shy. So she didn't mix with people, but she was very active in thespians and often had leading roles.
Tell the story. There's this, of course, there are so many odd and interesting and unusual stories about her, but this, the one I'm thinking of is this thing. When she was 16 years old, she apparently disappeared for a few days and nobody knew where she was?
Yeah. Talking to the family and reading, everything I could find, secondary in terms of that, and then primary in terms of her family, is that when she was a teenager in high school, she just disappeared. And the only account I have is that when she came home, at the time, this was the 50s in Charleston, West Virginia. So if Mom, Ruth, knew what happened, you just didn't talk about it. And I heard later she went off and was some group selling magazines. But, I don't really know. And the siblings don't really know because you just didn't talk about it.
Well, that I guess that, there would be many stories along the way to come when Sarah Jane did things or went places, and maybe only she truly knows where she was and what she was doing.
Absolutely. A lot of it is locked inside her head. What distressed her and why she got angry with me and her last words to me were, "I am no longer at home to you." Which was a phrase I'm guessing that is regional. It basically says, go away, get lost.
If you knock on the door, I'm not going to answer.
Exactly. I found out things that she didn't expect me to find out. And then that was when I started, calling people to set up interviews, and she was, chagrined that I would even know about these people, let alone ask to talk to them. And these are the people that knew a lot of things about her that were not, privileged information as attorneys and lawyers or doctors or things like that, but people that knew her and told me stories about her. And she's very complex, and she would present a personality to one person. Her personality to me was always consistent. I never knew about anyone else that visited her at the prison. She never slept over 27 years. I found out now that there's another woman that she was visiting with for the same 27 years. Never heard her name.
Hmm.
Ever. So, you know, it was difficult to knit her together. Because everyone knew a different person, and much more so than we walking around the street in terms of our work personality or home personality, this and that.
Hmm. Our guest, just to introduce for anyone who might have tuned in the last 5 or 6 minutes, Jerry Spieler. She's an investigative journalist. She's written for the Los Angeles Times, San Francisco Chronicle, Forbes, and she is the author of a book, Taking Aim at the President, The Remarkable Story of the Woman Who Shot at Gerald Ford. And the story is the story of Sarah Jane Moore, who in 1975 took a shot at Gerald Ford and came very close to hitting him. She could well have killed him. The story is quite interesting, and if you'd like to read the book, you can seek it out. And, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. After she graduated from high school, she studied nursing for a while, and then she abruptly dropped out and she joined the Army and ended up married to a serviceman. She married a Marine, and this was the first of a number of marriages. Did that seem, in what you know about her, and perhaps also in talking to people who knew her at the time, did that seem like a strange thing to do, not only to abruptly quit the study of nursing, and apparently she was a good student and probably would have been a good nurse, but to do that and suddenly to then join the military?
One of the patterns that I saw and that what her brothers told me is that once she achieved something, then she was no longer challenged and she, you know, would move on. So once she was accepted into nursing school and was succeeding, then she's, well, you know, this is done. I'm bored. I'm going to go into the military and go into the officer's candidate school or something. So it was consistent. It was shocking to people who didn't quite know her and frustrating because why would you do that, you know? I think she got married to get out of the house. And then she decided she was going to, you know, do something else with that and ended up quitting that and married an Air Force, you know, captain who actually was the father of three of her children or maybe four. So once she achieved something, she got bored. And that was the side of her personality, I think, that, you know, could have added to these layers of complications that are interesting because you don't see it in any of her other siblings. You know, they don't seem to have that characteristic of jumping from one thing to another. But she's very bright and very talented and very well spoken. And inside, I think she just needs continued, you know, recognition. And the only way she gets that is by starting new things and achieving them.
Mm. She, here is yet another one of these odd stories. She, it was at the time that she was in the military, she was in Washington, D.C., and she apparently was on a tour of the White House with a tour group and fainted. And then when they went to her and tried to help her out and see what was going on with her, said she didn't know who she was. And this all seems very strange, particularly the fact that it happened on the grounds of the White House makes you wonder what was in her mind at the time.
Yeah, that's really difficult to explain. And if you remember, she had a packet of photographs of herself on her.
Yes.
And so they published the photograph of, do you know this woman? And, of course, those records are sealed. You know, any psychiatric records are sealed. The only psychiatric information I have is from her, you know, hearing by the psychiatrist. But this was before that, and you know, it could have been another way to get attention, or she really did faint, and why she had the pictures with her, I don't know, but it was a very odd circumstance, and there's a tremendous amount of speculation as to why she did this, And was it a way to get out of the military where she didn't have anything to do with it? It goes to the complexity mm-hmm. of this person, who is a powerful person, and able to really think through plans, which is the scary side.
Yeah. We have a caller. We can bring them into the conversation at this point. Anybody else who is listening, by the way, of course, questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Caller here is in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
She sounds like a very fascinating person and indeed very complex. And I think... it sounds like she was not thrilled that you were going to write about her. And I'm just wondering, when an author writes about another person and the author's book sells, is any of that financial gain then sent to the person whose life you were recounting?
Not in this circumstance. Sarah Jane is a federal prisoner, so I didn't have to put an authorized biography on it because she was a public person and a felon. Years ago, I had offered to sell her art that I was holding for her and give the money to her son, at that time the only son I knew of,
mm-hmm.
and she did not want to do that. So if there is any money to be recovered from this publication, and there isn't, she cannot profit from her crime, and that's the Son of Sam law. So she can't write a book and get money from it, and there's not going to be any funds really available for her. So it depends on the circumstance. And as I said, she was a felon. And so, therefore, she did not have any rights to that.
And if you do make any money, will some of that go to her children?
I really can't answer that because I don't know what's going to happen with the book. So I really don't know. You know, it would depend on what happens. At the moment, the book is just a book, and it's in the industry. There's more money that goes out than comes in. So I've offered a lot of different things to the children. They're very happy. They want their privacy. So I think that they would just want to keep it that way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, nobody ever turns down money. And
that's for sure.
Money and privacy are not the same thing. So,
yeah.
But she sounds like a fascinating person. I can see why you were so enthralled with her character.
I don't know if enthralled is the right word. I felt this was a piece of history, and certainly the Secret Service has taken a lot of interest in it because when they let her go, they completely changed the threat assessment profile of what they used to look at. I mean, she really almost killed our president by 6 inches from a faulty gun, and it really put the Secret Service into a tizzy. And I have been contacted by security agencies to talk to them about her personality because they still are concerned about missing that. So it was more about a security and a piece of history that the public doesn't know.
Yeah. Well, I want to appreciate the comment of the caller. Others are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. And I want to make sure that at a point, and we're getting almost close to the midpoint, that we do talk about the fact that she was indeed known to the government, known to the Secret Service. They had perhaps reason to believe that she might do something really unfortunate and unpredictable. And in fact, here we're sort of jumping ahead in the story. And in fact, when she announced that she was planning on going to see the president, they knew that she had a gun. They called her in. They took her gun away, and they sort of patted her on the head and say, "Now go ahead and be a good girl," and let her go. And what she did was she went right out and she bought another gun. And as you say, as a result, the Secret Service started to think very differently about how it is that they go about protecting the president, because it just seems a little mind-boggling that they didn't. Oh, for example, I suppose they could have just arrested her and held her for 24 hours until the president was out of town, and perhaps this never would have happened.
Well, that's true. and there was an awful lot of discussion, I guess you could say, after, because there were three agencies involved. There was the San Francisco Police Department with Jack O'Shea at the head. There was the San Francisco office of the FBI. And then there was the San Francisco office of the U.S. Secret Service. All three agencies were involved in that weekend. President Ford was dedicating a building, the new law school at Stanford, on that Sunday, September 21st. The same morning that she was arrested, Sarah Jane Moore worked with what was called Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms of the Treasury Department, and she went with them on a covert operation to uncover an arms dealer. If you want to talk about strange, there was Sarah Jane with the ATF, with them, working with them to uncover an arms dealer. When she came home, the police were waiting because she had told Jack O'Shea that she was going to help test security for President Ford to make sure that the FBI and the police were doing their job. Mm-hmm. And that was the red flag with Jack O'Shea to call his people and say, you need to arrest Sarah Jane Moore. She's got a gun, and she's going to test security for President Ford. So when she came back home after being a covert operator, they took away her .44, which is the gun she was practicing with, and then they let her go. And she went home. And then the Secret Service came, and they interviewed her, and she told them all the wonderful things she'd been doing about, you know, being an informant for the FBI and believing in her country. And they couldn't believe that a 45-year-old mother of a 9-year-old and former doctor's wife could possibly be a threat, because the threat assessment was a 20- to 40-year-old foreign-born male and loner. And that all went away the next day. And that was the pivotal moment that the Secret Service had meetings, and you can read in their documents about changing their threat assessment.
And this, you mentioned at the beginning of the program that maybe, in fact, some people will confuse Sarah Jane with Squeaky Fromm, mm-hmm. Another woman who waved a gun at the president, although it seems that she, as you say, it seems that she didn't intend to kill the president, because the gun was, the chamber apparently was empty. So pulling the trigger would not have done anything. At the same time, and I know that you talked about Mr. Ford about this, I would think if you were the president of the United States and twice in less than 2 weeks somebody had been pointing a gun at you, I think you would turn to the Secret Service and say, what are you doing? Aren't you supposed to be protecting me?
I did interview President Ford in 2003. It was delightful. And we talked about sentencing. And whether you agree or disagree with this, you know, he did make a point. He said anyone that, you know, tries to assassinate the president should be given the same sentence, because the fact that they missed isn't the issue. I mean, if they missed, thank goodness, you know. But their intent was to kill. And if Sarah Jane had her 44, and four people have testified to this, we would have had a tragedy. And that was the Secret Service agent, Gary Yager, and there's a film of his testimony, because he was a Secret Service agent on duty that day. The policeman who grabbed Sarah Jane, Tim Hetrick, the FBI case agent whom I interviewed with Judge Conte, Richard Vitamonte, and Judge Samuel Conte in his testimony, or his talking to Sarah Jane, saying the only reason you missed is you had a faulty gun.
Mm-hmm.
That's frightening, because if she had aimed for his chest, again, I don't know what would have happened.
Yeah.
It's really frightening.
She was a good enough shot, so that if she had had her own gun, she would have hit him, and what she had to do when they took away her gun was go out and get another one. And apparently on this gun, the sights were a little bit off. And so she was off apparently just by inches of hitting the president.
She the gun, she was a marksman. Sarah Jane had been in the military, and she practiced, and she was a Southern girl. They know how to use guns. And fortunately, the sight was off high, but Richard Vidamonte said she had him between the eyes. Tim Hetrick said she had him between the eyes. Mm. And there was a chip on the concrete at the St. Francis Hotel, it's not there anymore, of where the bullet actually hit. And then ricocheted and hit a cab driver, I think, in the ankle. So, she was serious. She was not waving her gun well. The only reason she didn't get to correct her shot is because Oliver Sipple, who was a hero, heard the shot and then had the presence of mind to grab her arm.
Yeah, so she only got to take one shot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Jerry Spieler. She's an investigative journalist. She's worked for written for the LA Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, Forbes. She makes her home in San Francisco. She's the author of the book Taking Aim at the President, The Remarkable Story of the Woman Who Shot at Gerald Ford. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan, and it is about Sarah Jane Moore, who attempted to kill President Ford in September 1975 in San Francisco. Questions welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Now, I know we're sort of jumping around in here, but I want to go back to an earlier point in her life. We talked a little bit about how she after she graduated from high school, she went to nursing school, then abruptly dropped out. She joined the Army. She married a Marine. She divorced him. She married again. This time it was a captain in the Air Force. They had children. They divorced. Then they remarried. Then they divorced again. There's another one of these curious stories. There's a story of how Sarah Jane sent her children to her parents. She said she was coming for a visit. The parents go down to meet the plane at the airport, and here are the kids, and they're all by themselves. And they were really afraid. They were afraid, well, what's happened to Sarah Jane? And it seems pretty clear that she wanted to be rid of her children, and she never intended to come there herself. She put the kids on the plane and sent them to mom and dad, and that was it.
Yeah, that was very, very shocking. She was divorced from Sid Manning. The little boy was like 9 months old. Christopher, and then Janet, I think, was 3, and then Sid maybe was close to 5. And back then, you could send infants on a plane. And her brother, Dana, drove to Cincinnati to meet his sister. And as people kept coming off the plane, he's waiting and waiting and waiting, and the next thing he sees is what we call stewardesses, they used to call stewardesses, carrying Christopher. Hmm. And no sister. And her parents were well into their 50s. And there are their 3 grandchildren. And they called the police. They couldn't find her. And she made a few collect calls and then basically disappeared until, there's like a big blank there in my story until she sort of reemerges at RCA Studios. But they never heard from her again until they heard about the assassination of President Ford. So that was 1956 to 1975. They had no idea whatever happened to their daughter.
So here the story jumps up to, we jump to, say, the mid-60s. She's living in California. She's working at this movie studio, RKO. She gets married again, divorces this man who worked in the movie business, who apparently actually was kind of famous for having worked on films like Citizen Kane and It's a Wonderful Life. They married, and then after a month, she left him pregnant with his child, moved to San Francisco, got married again to a physician, and was involved in a political campaign at this point for George Murphy, who was a conservative Republican. And the reason that's so strange is that then in the early 1970s, she starts to become involved in the new left politics of the time, which and it just seems a little odd, like, you just sort of shake your head and say, wait a minute, you were here working for this conservative Republican, and then a couple of years later, suddenly you're involved in the extreme left anti-war movement of the time and by the mid-70s. That just doesn't make a whole lot of sense somehow.
try to make sense out of this book, I think you'll have a time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, she was, on one side, I mean, Sarah Jane is very well-read and very well-spoken and a very intelligent woman, very intellectual. And she, in her way, I mean, really dove deeply into things. And one of her comments to me in her letters was, you know, when I moved to Danville, I wasn't going to be one of those people that stopped taking the newspapers because I didn't want to see any bad news. You know, she did not want to be a country club, a stereotype of someone who maybe isn't in touch with what's going on around her. And that, we can't say that about people who go to country clubs because it's not true necessarily, but, you know, an image. And she did some good things. There was they were building this community, the Sycamore community she was living in, and one of the construction workers fell and died. And Sarah Jane got together and got a fundraising group together to raise money for his family. And so that was sort of the grassroots side of her. She became sort of disaffected with that community. She had a very long, torturous divorce, which is a movie on its own about what went on back and forth. And by that time, she was sort of emotionally extricating herself from the community, from the George Murphy campaign type thing. And at that time is when Patty Hearst was kidnapped by the Symbionese Liberation Army. I think it was the turning point where Sarah Jane stopped focusing on Danville and started getting very interested in the New Left and the embroilment of the San Francisco political community.
And that gets us into another strange and a story of the time that I'm sure people will recall, and it has to do with Patty Hearst, her kidnapping by the Symbionese Liberation Army, apparently, Sarah Jane was really fascinated by Patty Hearst.
It wasn't being fascinated by Patty Hearst. It was being fascinated by what was going on around it. Patty Hearst was the vehicle that, you know, forced the Symbionese Liberation and forced, you know, her father, Randolph, to give money to feed the poor. And the way that that happened is that he called the fellow from from Washington to set up a food giveaway bank, which turned into, there was a big warehouse in San Francisco in China Basin. It was like an airplane hangar, and to gather in food donated from all over, and then an army of people to manage this process. So it was an event. Anybody could come and volunteer. And you had the most conservative of organizations who wanted to help the Hearsts, to the other end with the Black Panthers, who wanted to be part of this righteous program to feed the poor. And on television, Randolph Hearst is asking for volunteers. And when you see this whole circus of people coming and going and everybody's doing things and, you know, it's like the center of the universe. And, you know, that was a magnet for Sarah Jane, plus she had accounting skills. No one turns away a volunteer that has accounting skills.
So she gets involved in this effort, and in the process comes to know some of these people who are involved in the politics of the New Left, and apparently is very sympathetic for them and what they're trying to do and their outlook and their issues, and gets involved in the politics of the New Left. Given all that, again, a very strange and surprising turn of events. She's recruited by the FBI to be an informant, trying to provide them information on what's going on in these left groups. Apparently, at the time, the FBI, they were particularly interested in any information that would help them find Patty Hearst. Again, she seemed to be very sympathetic to the aims of the New Left, and yet at the same time agreed to, literally, to be a spy. within the left for the FBI.
Yeah, that was a fascinating time. San Francisco in the 70s was, you know, had the every group here, the New World Liberation Front, which is a breakoff of the Students for Democratic Society, lots of underground socialist groups, certainly lots of Vietnam Vets Against the War organizations. They had a large chapter here. And the SLA and the Black Panthers, it started in Oakland. And so when she volunteered, she was coming in as this, you know, professional accountant. And she met everyone. Sarah Jane knows everyone. And one of the major characters that she met was Popeye Jackson, who was an ex-felon and part of, at the time, a very strong prisoners union organization. And, of course, the FBI was there because they were to help, you know, Randolph Hearst find his daughter who was kidnapped. So you have the FBI crawling all over the PIN, which is People in Need, which I neglected to say, which is the name of the organization to give away the food. And Sarah Jane's the accountant, and they're watching her. And the FBI was still using an old program called COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program, to find people to infiltrate any organization that they think is a threat to our government. And this is a gadfly. This woman's a gadfly. And they think, boy, she's perfect. So when they recruit her, they're telling her that you're helping your country. And she wants to help her country. And it's flattering. And she says, well, yeah, I'd like to help Mr. Hearst find his daughter. And that's the hook. Is how can you help Mr. Hearst? And Randolph Hearst himself recruited Sarah Jane separately. It gets very colorful.
Yes, indeed. So then we come to this point where she apparently, when she was working at Penn, was kind of hard to work with, and eventually they told her, just, I'm sorry, we can't deal with you anymore, and she was fired, but continued to be involved with some of these new left groups, continued to inform for the FBI, at the same time becoming increasingly sympathetic to the left and their aims and their ideas. So then we come to this odd situation where she's actually working for both sides. She told the folks on the new left that she was an FBI informant. So she is reporting to the FBI about what the new left people are thinking. She's reporting to the new left people what the FBI are thinking. And she's a double agent. And I think eventually gets to the point where she alienates everybody because she's trying to be all things to all people.
Yeah. And she did that. Actually, she quote-outed herself twice. One of the people that the FBI wanted her to report on was someone that she calls Tom, who she will never identify. And the FBI knew that she was the only one who really knew who this person was, and she wouldn't tell them. But she told Tom that she was an agent for the informant. And he said, you know, I won't tell anyone, but you have to stop doing this, and this isn't right. And so, but she went ahead anyway. And then when the FBI threatened her because they knew what was going on, she said, I am going to, you know, go public. And they said, we can't protect you, you know. And she did have death threats, but in her mind, she was, I think, trying to cleanse herself, so to speak. And, the process by which this happened, which I talk about in the book, is very convoluted. And her thought process of what she was trying to accomplish was very confusing. And she was committed to the underground. She was angry at the FBI, but she was also angry at the underground for what she called being naive. And this builds and builds and builds. And eventually she gets taken in by a very dangerous organization, which were the people that she aligned herself with as she was approaching, you know, a couple of weeks before killing the president. So when she kept saying, I acted alone on that day, she did act alone on that day. And on that day is the key phrase.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Jerry Spieler. She's an investigative journalist. She's author of the book Taking Aim at the President, The Remarkable Story of the Woman Who Shot at Gerald Ford. It is published by Palgrave Macmillan. We now have about 10 minutes left. We talked a little bit earlier about the events surrounding the assassination attempt, that the police, the FBI, they knew who she was. They knew that she had a gun. They knew that the president was going to be there, and she said something like, well, I'm going to go and help you test the security around the president. So they thought, oh, this is an accident waiting to happen. They pulled her in. They took away her gun. She went out and bought another gun and went ahead and took the shot at the president and came very close to killing him. Afterward, what did she say about what she had done and why?
She said she's sorry she missed. And she felt that the people that she was representing, the people, had no choice in terms of changing the way our government was running, that it was not representative of the people, that Ford wasn't elected and Rockefeller wasn't elected, and that the organizations that did want to overthrow our government, and there were many in San Francisco at the time, felt that if Ford, you know, it wasn't him personally, but he was an unelected president, that if he were eliminated, that the country would be so outraged at Rockefeller being our president that we would then have a revolution and put in people that were more representative of, you know, the population of the United States. And there, at the time, there were many, many organizations in San Francisco. 86% of the information the FBI called were from informants. So it was a very active group. And the reasons were, they were idealized, you know, of changing the government. In her mind, in their minds, that's what we needed to do to her.
Hmm. After she was arrested, a number of psychologists talked with her and did their assessments and found her competent to stand trial. What other things, though, did they say about her, and does that give one any kind of insight into what she's all about?
You know, she had six psychologists and six psychiatrists, and, of course, you know, her medical records are sealed, but I have, you know, the testimony. And they all had a different, quote, diagnosis. The diagnosis that they came up with varied from compartmentalizing personality. They all said she was sane. The psychiatrist said that she could have had, you know, some, we could put labels on it, but they could have said bipolar or hysterical. They had these different labels, but none of them agreed. None of the people who examined her agreed. They all did agree, though, that she was very controlled, and they had a very difficult time examining her because she wouldn't talk about her childhood. She wouldn't talk about her earlier life. She wouldn't talk about her husband, or the only son she talked about was Frederick. So they made it very difficult. She was extremely controlled.
Hmm.
But they did identify that she did, you know, take roles, different roles for different times and for different people.
She pleaded guilty. She went to jail. She began serving her sentence in January of 1976. And then on the last day of 2007, she was released from jail. She's on parole, so I expect that someone in the government knows where she is. But as far as the public is concerned, she just disappeared?
Yes. She does not know. She does not want anyone to know where she is. And she's made that very clear. I have her art collection. I have kept it in storage for 30 years. No, 27 years, something like that. Somewhere along the way, someone had rescued the art from her apartment that had been ransacked and couldn't keep it, and she asked me if I would keep it, and it was just a few pictures. It turned out to be 36. And I thought her son was going to take it, Frederick, when he was old enough, and he didn't want it. And so she has a lawyer that I've been talking with to get the art back to her, which I really, really would like her to take back because I really don't care to keep paying for it to be in storage. And it has been made clear to me she does not want anyone to know where she is. Mm-hmm. She doesn't want me to know. She doesn't want anyone to know. She wants to be completely private.
And is it this is yet another strange part of the story and how it gets you tangled up in it. As you said, you had it, you were holding on to it, you were actually paying money to have it stored. Now is it do I have this right that someone has said, "Oh, you stole it," or you're trying to profit by it or something like that?
Well, there's two issues there. Yeah. When Greg Dunning, who was the neighbor who rescued this art, took it in for her, and he didn't have a lot of money. At one point, he wrote to her and he said, I really can't keep your art anymore. Why don't you let me sell it, and I'll give the money to Frederick? And she accused him of stealing her art and hired a lawyer to sue him.
Hmm.
And he said, I'm not trying to steal your art. I'm just telling you I can't afford to keep it anymore. 36 pictures. Some of them large. That's when I took it. She called the publisher and demanded to try to find me, which she knows where I live. And then her lawyer, contacted me, and I said, well, I need to know that this is indeed going to Sarah Jane, because what if somebody picks it up and it doesn't go back to her? And so there was a threat that I was trying to steal it. I don't want it. I'm not trying to profit by it. I'm not asking for the $12,000 I've spent storing it. That was my decision, not hers. I just would love for her to have it back since it was, she said it was very important to her. Mm-hmm. But I have to be careful because a lot of people have come forward saying they're her friends and they're here to collect her art. And I don't have to paint a picture for you.
Sure. Clearly, there are people thinking, well, there would be people who might be willing actually to pay some serious money, maybe for something that she had painted. So clearly, there are people who think they can make some money off the deal.
Right. Yeah. I made a promise in 1986 to keep her art for her family, I really expected. And no matter what happened, I felt like, I kept that promise. And a promise is a promise, and now you're out. I really want you to have it back, but I want to make sure it goes to you.
Yes. We're at the point here, we have about a minute or two left. We talked about the fact, right, and mentioned that she, she pleaded guilty, she went to jail, she served her time, she did 32 years, and then she was released. But that makes her the only person who actively attempted to assassinate a president ever to be released from prison. Now, later this year, apparently in August, Squeaky Fromm is also, I think, set for release, and you can argue whether she did or didn't actually try to kill him. But Sarah Jane, at this point, is the only one. Does that say anything, or do there people are there people who raise questions about the fact that she had indeed intended to do this, afterwards said what she said was, I'm sorry I missed, and yet she's now free?
I think, from what I understand, it was sort of a legal technicality when Judge Conte had, sentenced her. And she did serve her time under the law at that time. And she apparently, they feel she's not a threat to society. Some would argue that it doesn't matter. She tried to kill our president. And I think that those laws or those sentencing are going to be looked at. If she were sentenced today, she may not have been released. A lot of things have been put in motion since that day, and the security agencies with our President Obama are now revisiting this very event. And who do we look for when we're trying to protect the president? So it's interesting. The flash forward, Squeaky Fromm also, people can argue all kinds of things. There was a gun, there was a president. You don't ask questions. I associate her more with the Manson family, although she didn't actively participate in that, but doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
I think that for whatever reason, we're taking a hard look at these issues. To me, Sarah Jane was really frightening. She wasn't 20-something. She didn't take drugs. She was a mother. She was middle class. And if you look at her picture, you'd never pick her out of a crowd.
Yeah. And ultimately, I guess I can see how, as someone, first of all, having known her, and then digging deeper into her life and seeing what a strange, twisted story it is, and what a puzzle it is that you would be interested in trying to figure it out.
Yeah, well, I when I saw this whole different side of her and learned of all these things that she had told me, which were lies, and how convincingly and how convoluted, I said, you know, we really need we need to understand this. If I can just sit here and blithely listen to her and go, okay, then I have an obligation to really dig this out, because this could be very important. And the calls I've gotten from these security agencies are saying, we're studying this. This is what we're training on. I had not expected that. My publisher didn't expect it. I didn't expect it.
Well, we're going to have to stop. The story is quite an interesting one. If folks want to read it, the book is Taking Aim at the President, The Remarkable Story of the Woman Who Shot at Gerald Ford. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan by our guest, Jerry Spieler. And Ms. Spieler, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on.